books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and this week I'm on location at the Boswell Book Festival talking to Damien Barr about his book The Two Roberts and actress Amanda Barry on her memoir I'm Still Here, My 90 Years. Plus we get the books of my life from the 2025 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction winner Percival Everett. All that, plus some new books in the RNIB library, coming up on today's Read On. Damien Barr is the author of several acclaimed books, including You Will Be Safe Here and Maggie and Me, which we'll find out in a moment, he narrated himself. His latest novel, The Two Roberts, tells the story of two very different men whose lives became intertwined. Spanning decades, it's a story about friendship, identity, family, and the secrets we keep. At its heart are two men living at a time when being open about their sexuality could come at a very real cost, forcing them to hide parts of themselves, even from those closest to them. It's a moving story about love, repression, courage, and the lasting impact of choices we make when we can't be entirely open about who we are. We'll hear from Damien in a moment, but first let's hear from the book, The Two Roberts, as narrated by Michael Aboubakar.
Bobby McBride is on his way. He's going to the Glasgow School of Art, to the big palace of painting on top of Garnet Hill, with the windows his mother says would take a month to clean. He's going to do painting. He's getting away. 5 years of tacking soles at Lee's Boots, and a lifetime it's taken to get here. To this morning, packing and repacking the khaki satchel his mother has made for him. "You'll miss your train," she shouts from the scullery, where the light is always best in the morning. His wee sister Jessie is at school already. His wee brother John is out looking for work. Their father is, as always, at Lee's. "I won't," says Bobby, ducking in to see her again for the final time. "Your father swapped a shift," his mother continues without looking up, "so don't be late." The dress she's unpicking is even more worn than her, but good cotton, washed, cut down and pressed. It will do well round the back doors of the big houses in Ayr. "I won't," says Bobby, noting a bundle from Mackay's, the butcher's, bleeding on the bunker, wrapped tight as a widow in the Kilmarnock Herald and North Ayrshire Gazette. "You shouldn't have," he says, noting the blurring headlines and wondering if the chicken was the freshest or the cheapest. "Ach, what's tick for?" his mother shrugs. "We're good for it, eventually. And your Auntie Maggie will be in the night as well." Bobby smiles, thinking of his Auntie Maggie and her stories and her harmonica. He slings his new bag over his shoulder. It feels so light for all the hope it holds. As the strap settles, he remembers what it took to get here, to this moment.
The Two Roberts is a novel written by me, which is a fictionalisation of the lives of two real Scottish artists, Robert McBride and Robert Cahoon, and they are both sons of Ayrshire. So McBride is from Maybole and Cahoon is from Kilmarnock, and they met at Glasgow School of Art in 1933. They fell in love as soon as they met. Each believed that the other was and could be an artist and a great artist, and so they push each other all the way through their degrees and their subsequent careers, which is a real kind of rags to riches and back to rags story. But they are briefly two of the most famous artists in the world during the Blitz in London. As the bombs fall, you know, their star is rising, and names that people will know, like Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon and Elizabeth Smart, people like that, they're younger, they're less famous than the Two Roberts. But yeah, they are these two real men who I've kind of fallen in love with, and whose love story inspired me to want to bring their story back to life, because I feel like they should be much more famous and celebrated than they are.
Bobby had boosted his escape fund By drawing cartoons of his workmates, he borrowed stubby pencils and brown paper from the pattern-making cupboard. He made big noses bigger, amplifying every wart into an Ailsa Craig. So long as he was equally unsparing, they'd all laugh. Folk crowded round him, pointing and laughing as familiar faces emerged. At first, it felt strange to draw in front of people, to have an audience for something he'd always done in secret, in the art room at lunchtimes or up Kildoon Hill, just him and the sky. He doubted his colleagues would enjoy watching him try to get the perfect morning blue of the wild periwinkles. They admired his skill. This kind of looking was safe, he realised, because they were seeing themselves. Word spread, as it always did, and folk brought in that one photograph of their cousin that's away to Canada or Australia. Every now and then, a tearful woman handed him a tissue-wrapped photo, and he refused money for these, drew them in private. Bobby got good at telling the stories of every face but his own, disliked his pouty lips, which sat right on his mother and Jessie. Avoiding himself was easy, because the only mirror in their house was a tile screwed to the wall over the scullery sink where his father shaved every morning, his face curled in steam. Anyway, there would always be somebody to catch him. A man shouldn't look at himself any longer than he needs to. Bobby knew the rules. So, he only ever saw himself in what people reflected back. If he could make them laugh, or give them back a face they'd lost, he liked what he saw.
They're known as the last Bohemians, and there are biographies of them. What did you do to fill in the blank spaces as well?
That's a really interesting question, because the richer, the closer you are to our idea of what a normal person is, if you're able-bodied, if you're rich, if you're straight, if you're white, if you're a man, we know kind of everything about your life because you're considered more worthwhile than people who are further from those things or distant or different from them. And the two Roberts are gay, they're Scottish, they're working class. And so there's a lot that we can't know about their lives because they have to destroy evidence that could be used against them. Friends of theirs were blackmailed, friends of theirs were sent to jail. So there's lots of letters that have been burnt, diaries that have been burnt, paintings that have been burnt. There are gaps in their story because their families weren't proud of them instantly. Certainly some of them are now, and I've worked closely with the families, but you know, family records are missing as well. And because they were Scots who went to England, you know, there was a sense, I think, that some Scots felt they'd turned their back on the country that they'd grown up in. So there are lots of gaps, and it's important to understand that that's not just a lack of care or the passing of time, it is prejudice in action. And so those, for me, writing the novel is about imagining myself into those parts of their lives which have been actively erased. So the romance, their love, them working together in their studio, painting together in their studio, being with their friends. You know, I wanted to take the shame and stigma that still persists, actually, I think, around them out and make them human again. It's a really long answer to your very pointed question, I'm sorry.
It was a wonderful answer. But they were homosexuals in a time when it was not only illegal, but it was actively persecuted.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, at the time they are growing up, you are sent to prison for being so-called homosexual or gay or whatever you want to call it, think of it at that time. And you're sent to jail. You're not just sent to jail, you're given hard labour, specifically for that so-called crime. So you're given hard labour, you're broken. You are then shamed in your community. So when you get out of jail, you know, you're shamed in your community. You might be married, you might have kids, you might have a job. You might not have any of those things, probably don't have when you get back out. So there's a huge amount of prejudice and discrimination that they encounter, that the friends of theirs encountered. You know, they write to other friends of theirs while they're in prison. There's one particular friend I'm thinking of who they meet at the gates of Wormwood Scrubs when he gets back out. You know, they live with the fear of jail all the time, and blackmail, and violence from the police.
Every Sunday, whatever the weather, Bobby took the paper he'd scrounged and went up Kildoon Hill. He raced away from the houses until he ran out of road or puff. Auntie Maggie was always saying, "You'll meet yourself coming back." He huffed his way up the rubbly track, the same one marched by Roman soldiers who built the fort at the top. Bobby imagined their sandaled feet, scuffed with faraway dust, swords hanging by their sides, dark eyes on a distant horizon. Why did they come here when they could be somewhere sunny? Where did they all go? He searched the faces at Lee's, wondering if any of them was ever Roman. Andrew, whose mother was a baker, had an olivey look. Sandra, sat next to him, was definitely an empress. Bobby was far from pale. His father claimed they're from the Black Irish, survivors of the Armada who washed up in Ireland and were welcomed with open, laugh, nudge, wink. If his ancestors did come from far away, then maybe Bobby could find his way back. Finally, at the top, Bobby would sit himself down on the nearest, driest rock and unpack his stuff, rushing to get it all down.
Now, we've heard through the magic of editing, Michael Aboubakar reading from the audio version of the book. Were you in any way responsible for his casting?
I was very involved with the casting of Michael Aboubakar. I have enjoyed his work as an actor before, and he did Caledonian Road for Andrew O'Hagan. Andrew O'Hagan is a fantastic, one of our best writers, also a son of Ayrshire and a fan of Robert Cahoon, as it happens. And I loved listening to Michael bring all the different characters of Caledonian Road, which is a really multifaceted, multi-character novel, to life. And what he really got about the two Roberts was that, you know, they have the same name, but they couldn't be more different. And he gives them this incredible range and humanity, and we grow old with them, we hear them grow old, we hear them fight, we hear them fall in love. You know, it's an astonishing work of genius, actually, I think. And so many people have come to the audiobook. I think of all the books that I've written before, this is the one where the audiobook has been most enjoyed, and I include Maggie and me, which I did myself in that. So, you know, he's a terrific actor. And I should also say we had a brilliant director on that, and it was really important to me that we have a director, you know, with some lived experience that he could bring to Michael. And it was really wonderful to see that partnership in action. So yeah, I'm very grateful to him and Canongate for helping me be involved in that.
Maggie and Me, written by Damien Barr, narrated by Damien Barr. It's the 12th of October, 1984. I'm just 8 years old. Me and my mum are stuck to the BBC 9 o'clock news in this strange new flat. We sit cross-legged on bare floorboards with coats for cushions and watch ambulances, police cars and fire engines meemaw, meemaw in black and white on the portable balancing on top of a tea chest. A flurry of dusty black bits fluttered out when I helped my mum turn it upside down. I thought tea only came in bags until this morning when the removal van came to take us to flat 1, number 1, Magdalen Drive, Kerfin. My dad is back at number 25, Ardgar Place, Newart Hill, with the big colour telly. My wee sister Teenie has cried herself to sleep in my mum's lap. Our old life is crammed in the cardboard boxes bursting all around us. It's way past my bedtime, but rules are already being broken. My mum lifts an arm so I can snuggle in. She lights a Regal cigarette and shakes her head at the telly, tutting and pulling me closer. I can't get close enough. Blue smoke cloaks us. Luck of the devil, she huffs, puffing away at the telly where this blonde woman rises from rubble again and again like a Cyberman off Doctor Who. All around her, the hotel is collapsing as bloody bodies are pulled out, but she stays calm. She's talking to the BBC with a man's voice, and even the police stop to listen. Life must go on as usual, she insists, as if life will do exactly what she tells it.
So Maggie and Me was about your childhood, growing up in Scotland under Thatcher. How was the process of you narrating that?
Well, it's interesting. So, Maggie and Me is a memoir, and it took, I think, 7 years to write, and I've worked on turning it recently into a play with National Theatre of Scotland, so it was another kind of rewrite of it, if you like, a reimagining of the process. But Writing it was very hard because I was told as a child all the time, nobody's going to believe you, you're not supposed to talk about what goes on at home. I was so used to keeping my sexuality a secret, but also the poverty of my family and all of these sorts of things. And for me, it was really hard to bring myself to be able to feel I had permission to do that. And I never thought about doing the audiobook, to be honest. I never thought that that would be something, I never thought it would be a book. So I never thought about doing the audiobook. And then my agent said to me, you're down to the last four. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm auditioning for the role of myself, reading the book of myself. This is ludicrous. Who are the other three people? I still don't know to this day. But anyway, I got the role of myself in the book of myself, by myself. And I haven't listened to it for a very long time. It won't surprise you to hear. But yeah, it was hard. I remember going to the RNIB studios and being there in London for a whole day and working on, well, actually, no, many days. But I remember the first day, it was so hard because also I was reading the work aloud and thinking, oh, that's not very good. That could be better. I could fix that, you know, and tweaking it as I went along. So the audiobook is the more updated version of the memoir.
The telly was first to get unpacked. The news was already on when Logan plugged it in. He thumped it hard, just once, and the picture cleared to show Maggie walking away from the bombed hotel. He shook his head and changed the channel, but there she was again. 9 hours of unpacking later, and the news is still on, and Maggie is still not dead. He can't believe it. Neither can my mum. They hate her, and they say she hates Scotland, hates us. But all the people on the BBC seem glad she made it. Secretly, I am too. I don't want to see her dead. I don't know why. Maybe just because everybody else does. She's not done anything to me. I'd like to brush the dust from her big blonde hair like she's a girl's world and tell her it'll all be all right. Of course, I can't admit this. Bitch, I say, the worst word I know, and flinch for a scalp. But my mum says nothing, not even a God forgive you. So I'm allowed to swear about Maggie. That's how bad she is. My mum takes one last puff. I don't want her to go and sleep in that bed with him. I close my eyes as she drops her cigarette hissing into the dregs of a cuppa and imagine celebrating Maggie's miraculous escape with the shiny, rich-looking people on the telly. The Grand Hotel survives. So does Maggie. So will I.
Thanks again to Damien Barr. His three books, You Will Be Safe Here, The Two Roberts, and his self-narrated Maggie and Me are all available from RNIB Talking Books.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Before we hear from Coronation Street and Carry On Cleo actress Amanda Barry about her 90 years, let's visit the RNIB library to find some new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. The Visionaries by James Holland was donated by Penguin Random House.
In 1913, New York City surpassed London to become the world's busiest port. Wall Street was the centre of the United States financial market, and Manhattan the most modern urban centre on the planet. It was also home to slums and extreme poverty, but that was not the point. Once immigrants saw the Statue of Liberty and passed through Ellis Island, the gateway to America, they could see with their own eyes a new world of possibility, progress and modernity. There were more than 900 cinemas. There were motor cars, large advertising hoardings lit up by electricity, all garish colours and brightness. There were immense civic buildings, air conditioning, art galleries, and towering skyscrapers. And at 7:30 p.m. on the 24th of April 1913, President Woodrow Wilson, inaugurated as the 28th president just a month earlier, hit a button in the White House in Washington, D.C., 200 miles away, and the world's tallest building was suddenly and dramatically swathed in electric light.
Although the Second World War was still a long way from being won, even by early 1941, US President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was already planning for peace. America's entry into the war may still have been almost a year away, but he could already see the new world order that was needed to emerge from the smouldering ashes of Europe. The business of war was very quickly going to have to become the business of peace. 3 years later, under the guidance of his successor, President Harry S. Truman, the Marshall Plan would emerge, a forward-thinking combination of global philanthropy and canny self-interest, which kick-started unprecedented European growth and the chance for the world as a whole to rebuild after the ruinous catastrophe of war. James Holland's knowledge of the Second World War and its aftermath gives him unique insight into the far-reaching consequences of the financial policies of Roosevelt and Truman. The sustained period of economic stability they initiated delivered peace to the Western democracies for over 80 years.
Designed by Cass Gilbert and commissioned by the entrepreneur Frank Winfield Woolworth, creator and owner of nearly 600 nationwide five and dime stores, the Woolworth building was 792 feet tall and towered majestically into the Manhattan sky. Who, seeing this, could possibly doubt the astonishing age of progress in which Americans now lived? Across the Atlantic, London might have been usurped as the busiest port in the world, but it remained the beating hub of the largest empire ever to have existed, and more to the point, the largest trading empire. Britain had global extra-imperial assets and interests beyond the boundaries of her empire. It meant that London was a truly multi-ethnic melting pot, but also the epicentre of the world's money. Free trade and a free gold market, noted The Economist in January 1913, are two of the key different advantages which we enjoy over all our competitors, and the chief means by which London maintains itself as the banker and financier of the universe. It also meant the city was awash with exoticism amid the smoke, soot and grime, and although a far older city in a far older nation than New York in the United States, it was also a metropolis seemingly on an upward trajectory of progress. The world was an inherently unstable place, and yet there had been peace, for the most part, throughout Europe for almost a century. Those who had fought through the long and bitter Napoleonic Wars had all long since gone, and while there had been plenty of colonial skirmishes and wars in far-flung places around the globe, and even revolutions and brief wars in Europe, the vast majority in the continent had existed in a state of peace since Napoleon was vanquished at Waterloo in June 1815.
The Visionaries, America and the Post-Second World War Dream, by James Holland, is narrated by Al Murray, and runs for 6 hours and 4 minutes.
The Wartime Book Club, by Kate Thompson, was donated by Hodder.
Grace Lamotti considered herself very lucky to be the acting chief librarian of St. Helier Public Library, or as it was known to most, the Bibliothèque Publique. One of the oldest libraries in the British Isles, established in 1736, as she was very proud to tell anyone who would listen, and those that wouldn't. It was her very own book-lined palace of dreams. Perhaps in the current climate, palace was overstating it. These days, everything was subject to rationing, and even their book stock had been severely depleted by the Germans' idea of what constituted an affront to the Third Reich. Shortly after the invasion, they had received a directive from the Feldkommandantur informing them the library would soon be visited for a full evaluation of stock and that all banned books must be turned over. She and Ash had weeded out most of the verboten, forbidden books, hiding them in a secure place, leaving some behind as collateral damage so the Germans hadn't suspected. They had come back, of course, 3 months after the invasion, and again last year, little grey men with rat-like faces, and stripped yet more. More authors, uncongenial to the Nazi regime, had vanished from the stacks. The expurgation didn't end there. Montagu Burton's, the Jewish tailors on the corner of King Street, had also received a visit. It didn't sell suits any longer, but was now a German bookshop. Mein Kampf and Famine in England were advertised in the window display under swastikas. It was so offensive that each time Grace walked past, she instinctively turned the other cheek.
Jersey, 1943. When the German army invades the tranquil island, Librarian Grace Lamote is determined to keep her services running. Ordered to destroy books which threaten the Nazi regime, she refuses, instead hiding them away and fighting back by forming a book club, a lifeline to help islanders escape the terror of war, one chapter at a time. But soon Grace's quiet acts of bravery become even more perilous. She's harbouring dangerous secrets, ones that put her life in danger, and when tensions turn to violence, she's forced to face the true, terrible cost of resistance. Based on astonishing real events, the Wartime Book Club is a love letter to the power of books in the darkest of times, as well as a moving page-turner that brings to life the remarkable untold story of an island at war.
Grace flicked her duster over the stacks and sighed. Not that they were faring much better. Her poor bookshelves looked like a smile with missing teeth. Jack London, H.G. Wells, John Steinbeck, Sigmund Freud and Ernest Hemingway all gone. Anyone considered by the Germans to be a dangerous, disruptive influence. "But you're still here, my old friends," she said, smiling as she ran her finger down the spine of Pride and Prejudice and the very last Agatha Christie, which had been delivered to the island on the mailboat before the Germans arrived, cards on the table. Agatha looked down at her knowingly. 800 new books, the lifeblood of a library, were delivered yearly, but no more. This last book from England had had more loans than any other over the past 3 years. When the war was over, Grace was tempted to write to Agatha Christie to tell her how her books had escaped a Nazi cull, unlike so many others.
The Wartime Book Club by Kate Thompson is narrated by Imogen Church and runs for 16 hours and 30 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book service and studios. The first talking books to be sent to listeners were on LPs made of shellac.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and you know, if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, from the story earlier on about keeping your sexuality hidden, we turn to another, although in a very different setting and a very different voice. Amanda Barry has been a familiar face on British television and stage for decades, perhaps known to many as Alma Sedgwick in Coronation Street. In her memoir, I'm Still Here, My 90 Years, she looks back on an extraordinary life and career, including the years when she kept her sexuality private in an industry and a society where being openly gay could carry a heavy price. It's a candid, funny and often revealing memoir about fame, love, survival and simply refusing to disappear. The book is narrated by Jan Ravens, but is introduced by Amanda herself.
Hello, I'm Amanda Barry. And yes, I am still here. When I started writing this book, someone said, Amanda, haven't you already told your story? And I said, darling, that was only Act One. This is the rest, including the bits I didn't tell you about before. I now have 90 years to share, 90 years of joy and sorrow, triumph and disaster, love and loss, and laughter and tears. 90 years of watching the world change around me, beyond my wildest imagination. 90 years, and still counting. Now, before we start, you might notice that this audiobook doesn't sound quite like me. Much as I'd love to have read it myself, there's a very good reason why I didn't. I lived my whole life with dyslexia, and while I have managed to learn quite a few scripts in my time, reading an entire book out loud, well, I'm sorry, but that is just absolutely impossible. It would probably take me the next 90 years, and I think the crew would have left by then. So, the wonderful Jan Ravens has done it for me. Jan's a brilliant comedian and actress. She's sharp, she's funny, and best of all, she can read. She's brought my words to life beautifully, and I couldn't be more grateful. Come with me, and I'll take you with me from my teenage days as a dancer in Soho, through the Carry On films, West End Leading Lady, Coronation Street, Bad Girls, Benidorm, Hell's Kitchen, Big Brother, Real Marigold. Oh, no, it just goes on, doesn't it, really? Alongside all the emotional ups and downs of my private life. It's been quite a ride, you know, and somehow I'm still here to tell the tale. So pour yourself a cup of tea or something a bit stronger if that's what you want, and let Jan take you through my 90 years. Ready? Okay. Let's begin.
Well, the book is about me, really. I was asked to do it. I did one before, but I was asked to do it when I got to my 90th. So I got asked to do another one. So I would never have thought of doing it, but apparently other people did. So that's why I did it, yeah.
25 years ago, the world celebrated the start of a new millennium. For me, a whole new life was beginning. A life I had never imagined would be possible. A life which gave me freedom from the constraints I'd always taken for granted. I was already in my mid-60s, and yet I was to experience what I can only describe as a rebirth. All my adult life, I had kept my true self hidden. I felt I had no choice. Now, finally, I could be myself. I came out as homosexual with a bang, which may not be the best way to put it, right across the tabloid press and on TV. And for a while, I was probably more afraid of what might happen to me because of my sexuality than ever before. I honestly wondered if I might be stoned in the street. But I noticed the world was changing. The law of the land was continuing to change. People around me had changed. And these changes kept coming. As fate would have it, I seemed to have extremely good timing. Suddenly, everybody was coming out. It was almost fashionable. So much so that as someone who was accustomed to being regarded as different and had been told off for it at school by various headmistresses, I did consider going back in again. Madonna kissed women on stage and it didn't seem to damage her career. So why had I been in such a state? Gay pride was becoming a phenomenon. People were singing and shouting that they were glad to be gay. It seemed that I may have missed something. And my coming out proved to be not at all how I had anticipated it.
Now, this one goes right back. What was your first time on stage?
First time on stage was when I was 3 at the theatre that my grandfather, I think, leased. And it was a Matcham theatre, which got pulled down, and there's a petrol station there, sacrilege. And I did pantomime, and I did 8 shows a week. No wonder I'm tired now. Yes, that's it. Yes, that was my first proper on stage.
And you've never really stepped off stage since?
No, darling, I've been working all that time. I've got to keep at it.
Now, tell us about your time as a chorus girl.
Actually, it started, the whole thing kicked off in Scotland. I owe most of my career from kicking off in Scotland because I'd been expelled from one school, and when I went to the next school, I got expelled again because I went off and did an audition for pantomime with Howard and Wyndham, which was all in Scotland, and it was very important. And I was the only person who got the audition, and I was too young, really. And I didn't do anything about it. And then they suddenly got a contract. And the next thing I knew, I was in Glasgow with Stanley Baxter playing Buttons. So that kicked off my chorus dancing career. And 8:05 and pantomime. So I worked with all their Scottish comics. Jimmy Logan, Jack Radcliffe, Ricky Fulton, Harry Gordon, the whole lot, Chick Murray. And they also, the producer up there changed my name. He said, you can't have a name like Broadbent. You cannot go into the theatre with a name like Broadbent. You'll never get anywhere. So he got me to change my name, and he gave me my first part off stage when I took over from Gillian Lynn in The Merry Widow, that was Howard and Wyndham production. So that's how I kicked off. And then I went back to London and danced on television all over the place. And then I went from that into doing review. And then it went to being a bit more in review. And then leading lady in the West End. And then seven.
And then carry on.
Oh, then. And then the carry ons came into my life. And I did Cleo first. Oh, no, I didn't. I did Carry On Cabby first. Then I did Cleo. Then I was asked to do all of them. And then my agent said, you're not doing that. Rubbish. You're going to Bristol Vic to do proper acting. So I was shipped off to Bristol Vic. And after that, I got my first West End leading lady bits.
Now, in the UK and many other countries, gay couples can marry. Then, gay men went to jail and gay women were ostracised. I have been a small part of a transformation. I'm now married to a woman. Our 11th anniversary falls on September the 12th, 2025, 2 days before my 90th birthday. Miracles do happen. I've been astonished at what life has presented me with over the first quarter of a century of the new millennium. Because without a doubt, the most extraordinary part of my story has come about since I decided to stand up and be counted. To young people today, there will seem nothing remarkable in any of it, and they could be forgiven for questioning why it took me so long. The thousands of other gay men and women who had to deal with the world the way it used to be would never need to ask that question. Even as an actress within an industry known for its liberal attitudes, tolerance, and acceptance of people who are different, I found that it was not always possible to be open. I firmly believed during my time in Coronation Street that I would have been sacked if my sexuality had become public knowledge. Actors and their characters often become as one in soap operas, and it would almost certainly have been felt that our viewers would not accept a gay Alma. Now, Coronation Street abounds with gay characters, to the extent that I have wondered if it should be renamed Canal Street after Manchester's famous gay area. Also, it seems almost irrelevant whether or not the actors who portray them are gay themselves, which is how it should be. Then, everything was so very different.
Now, we've heard clips of the book as read by Jan Ravens. Why didn't you read it yourself?
Darling, I can't read a postcard. Oh, my God. I think that's one of the reasons I was expelled from schools. I can read. Can't read out loud at all. I mean, I've conquered most other things, but when they said, when I read the book, I just went, well, we'd be here till I'd be dead, darling, by the time I'd... I could not do it. I might get a paragraph done and then it seizes up completely. I can't read it. And it doesn't make any sense. And I went, oh, I can't do that. We did discuss it before, actually, but I thought, oh, no, God, I can't do that. Absolutely hopeless. I mean, there's just so many mistakes and miss things that you just, you know. No.
It would sound lovely.
It wouldn't, darling, it would be. I couldn't get it out. It wouldn't be any lot of rubbish. Googly gook.
Now, throughout that glittering career, there was a shadow over it in your sexuality. You thought that if your sexuality came out, the career may end. When did that fear stop?
Well, actually, writing the book helped it stop. But the actual change in, I don't know, society or whatever you want to call it, people's attitudes, I suppose it didn't really change for me until about 2000. And it did change that. And it also changed for me when I did the book, because it just hung over my head. And I know people call it sexuality, but I would call it more emotionality. I would really put that in big signals over everybody's head. It's, you know, you can't help what your emotions do. I mean, sexuality is a different thing altogether, but it is viewed that way, isn't it, really? But I dare say a lot of people have been emotionally attached to not realise probably that's the direction they should have been going in. And so, but then the attitudes, in the last 20 years, the attitudes have changed extraordinarily, particularly with young people. I mean, they don't bat an eyelid. You know, they really don't bat an eyelid. They go, oh, yes, I tried that, but it didn't work. You know, I mean, they simply don't. It doesn't matter. They don't, they really don't. It don't bother as much as our previous times.
Have you ever seen a fox lurking about in your garden? You may have noticed that it has its head lowered down, that it looks furtive and frightened. And if you make any move towards it, it will disappear into the shadows. The fox knows, absolutely knows, it is going to be exterminated if it's found out, because it's some sort of vermin, some sort of diseased creature. Along with a lot of other people at that time, I believed absolutely that I was a diseased creature. That is pretty much how, right through the 20th century, I lived my life. And it was brought much more into focus when I joined Coronation Street as Alma Sedgwick, later to become Alma Baldwin. In the 80s and 90s, Corrie regularly pulled in 18 or 19 million viewers per show, more for a special episode. The show where Alma and I nearly drowned when she was driven into the murky waters of Salford Quays by deranged taxi driver Don Brennan attracted almost 20 million viewers. The Street still brings a degree of instant fame, probably exceeded by certain reality shows now. In those days, from the moment you appeared on the cobbles, the level of attention was overwhelming. You were recognised everywhere you went. I've never minded that. From the start, I considered it a privilege to be recognised and approached by people who'd watched you on stage or screen and just wanted to meet you. It's what this business is about. But there is the other side to it.
Is there anyone in your life, related or friend, that's got sight problems?
Oh, me? Oh, I had a retina vein occlusion when I was in Coronation Street. For quite a while, it was completely on its way out. And then it did its miracle of throwing another blood vessel, which normally turned back onto the eye, I believe, but mine didn't. And it exited. But it's completely, I mean, I can see light, but I can't see at all properly. I mean, I have to go sometimes. They sent me for glasses, and I go for glasses, and to be quite honest with that, I can't even see the thing. So, but I did go through that really frightening time when you have, obviously the people I'm talking to have all been through it with, and a very scary, frightening time. You don't appreciate what you've got until you're suddenly, I think it's going to be taken away from you. Suddenly, you just take your eyesight for granted. And I so admire the people who've coped and done all sorts of things and gone on with it.
Is it important that your book's in audio so anyone can access it?
Yes, yes. You can read me an audio if you want to. That'd be good. Yes, but you wouldn't have understood me, never done anything else if I'd been trying to. Oh dear, so embarrassing. It was only once in my life when I was at school. They could never let me read, you know, the morning sermon thing. And one time everybody had mumps, and it was me that had to do it. And they gave it to me the night before, and I practiced and practiced and practiced. I thought, I will get this right if it kills me. And I got up next morning, went into assembly, and I started to read it. And I thought, I'm not doing too badly, I'm doing all right here, until suddenly I was dragged out of assembly, and they went, how dare you sort of make jokes. I thought, what have I done? And what I'd done was I read, and he went up into the swine, a gogu. Actually, the word was synagogue. I just thought he was amazed at the swine. And so, I mean, you can imagine if I'd read the book, what it'd come out like upside down, down, down. It would have been struggled through.
As a Corrie regular, the tabloids were desperate to expose the most inconsequential details of your private life. In my case, there was always the little matter of my sexuality. And back then, there was nothing inconsequential at all about a major character in the biggest soap in the world being revealed to be gay. Previously, the bulk of my work had been theatre. As a West End leading lady fortunate enough to appear in a succession of major productions in almost all of our great London theatres, I attracted considerable recognition. But that was like lying in a calm sea riding a flow of gentle waves compared with the fight to stay afloat when faced with the tsunami of fame which came with the territory of Weatherfield. Nothing had prepared me for it. The fox was utterly terrified. Its head was bowed right down to the ground. I was frightened of everything and everybody, fear of loss of work, fear of tabloid headlines, and indeed just fear of the opinions of others. I always felt terrified and guilty, with no idea why sometimes, except that everything seemed against me and almost everyone seemed to be a predator of some sort. As a young woman, I developed serious mental health issues which lasted for many years, all whilst making a bit of a name for myself in West End theatre and films, notably Carry On Cleo. And of course, becoming that well known didn't help at all with my abiding fear of being found out for what I really was.
Thanks again to Amanda Barry. I'm Still Here, My 90 Years is available in all formats commercially. Her previous autobiography, It's Not a Rehearsal, is in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally, on today's show, how about a Books of My Life from the winner of last year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, author of Erasure, The Trees, and James, among many others. Here's Percival Everett. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, of course, there are many. My first real love of any fiction was with Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, as a very small child. And then when I was nine, from my father's shelf, I grabbed Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage, thinking that I wasn't supposed to be reading it. And of course, I read it secretly and felt scandalous and excited about it. Though, of course, no one would have cared. To me, everyone would have cared. And it gave me a lesson about reading, that it's the most subversive thing we can do. When no one knows what the words are doing when they enter us. No one can read over our shoulders or hear what we hear. This is why fascist regimes seek to burn books, because a populace that reads is a populace that thinks.
The day broke grey and dull. The clouds hung heavily, and there was a rawness in the air that suggested snow. A woman servant came into a room in which a child was sleeping and drew the curtains. She glanced mechanically at the house opposite, a stucco house with a portico, and went to the child's bed.
"Wake up, Philip,"
she said. She pulled down the bedclothes, took him in her arms, and carried him downstairs. He was only half awake.
"Your mother wants you,"
she said. She opened the door of a room on the floor below and took the child over to a bed in which a woman was lying. It was his mother. She stretched out her arms, and the child nestled by her side. He did not ask why he had been awakened. The woman kissed his eyes, and with thin, small hands felt the warm body through his white flannel nightgown. She pressed him closer to herself.
"Are you sleepy, darling?"
she said. Her voice was so weak that it seemed to come already from a great distance. The child did not answer, but smiled comfortably. He was very happy in the large, warm bed, with those soft arms about him. He tried to make himself smaller still, as he cuddled up against his mother, and he kissed her sleepily. In a moment he closed his eyes and was fast asleep. The doctor came forwards and stood by the bedside.
"Oh, don't take him away yet,"
she moaned.
That's Christopher Oxford reading Of Human Bondage by W. Somerset Maugham, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, as is, of course, Peter Pan. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
Oh, well, I live in Los Angeles, so we don't get very many rainy days. This is going to sound like a really obtuse answer, but I often read philosophy instead of, or math instead of fiction. And just to relax and to play, I really like looking at almost anything written by Bertrand Russell, whether it's Why I Am Not a Christian to the Mathematica Principia, which is all symbolic logic, but I just like thinking.
The ending of the war enabled me to avoid several unpleasant things which would otherwise have happened to me. The military age was raised in 1918, and for the first time I became liable to military service, which I should, of course, have had to refuse. They called me up for medical examination, but the government, with its utmost efforts, was unable to find out where I was, having forgotten that it had put me in prison. If the war had continued, I should very soon have found myself in prison again as a conscientious objector. From a financial point of view also, the ending of the war was very advantageous to me. While I was writing Principia Mathematica, I felt justified in living on inherited money, though I did not feel justified in keeping an additional sum of capital that I inherited from my grandmother. I gave away this sum in its entirety, some to the University of Cambridge, some to Newnham College, and the rest to various educational objects. After parting with the debentures that I gave to Eliot, I was left with only about £100 a year of unearned money, which I could not get rid of as it was in my marriage settlement. This didn't seem to matter, as I'd become capable of earning money by my books. In prison, however, while I was allowed to write about mathematics, I was not allowed to write the sort of book by which I could make money. I should therefore have been nearly penniless when I came out, but for the fact that Sanger and some other friends got up a philosophical lectureship for me in London. With the ending of the war, I was again able to earn money by writing, and I've never since been in serious financial difficulties, except at times in America.
That's John Richmond reading from the autobiography of Bertrand Russell, one of a number of volumes available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Well, there is. Jing Su's Kingdom of Characters. An American academic, she's Chinese, is a wonderful book about the Chinese language and how so much work had to be put into making it accessible for use with the rest of the world. Chinese being a very different language that's not phonetic, even to the point that the creation of a Chinese typewriter was a remarkable event.
Kings, clerics, adventurers, scholars, modern poets, and theorists of language were drawn to its strangeness and exceptionality, looking for a key to unlock its secrets through grammar and compositional laws. 16th century Jesuit missionaries labored to learn it. 17th century savants were fascinated by it, and 18th century sinologists fetishized it. How an entire civilization outside of Christendom evolved to have a writing system as complex and massive as a Chinese script has been an enduring linguistic mystery for outsiders. This inquiry poorly masks a deep suspicion. How can a people who read and write in characters ever think the way we do? Even in the late 20th century, views like this were touted by Western experts in different fields. Alphabetic thinking, social theorists would say, explains the advent of the scientific revolution in the West. A modern theorist of networks and the digital age sees the alphabet as a conceptual technology that forms the bedrock of Western science and technology. A scholar of ancient Greece saw the signs much earlier at the fount of Western civilization, where the alphabetic mind was responsible for all the West's accomplishments. Joseph Needham, a renowned British historian of Chinese science, spent his life's work defending scientific inventions in ancient China against claims like these. But he also recognized that the Chinese language remained the greatest barrier for Westerners to understanding the minds of the Chinese. It is China's first and last Great Wall.
That's Jing Zhu reading from her book Kingdom of Characters, A Tale of Language, Obsession and Genius in Modern China. It's available both commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And Percival Everett, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are almost 500 episodes of Read On available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. And tune in to RNIB Connect Radio every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books. The full schedule and the current book is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.